Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Logan resident Andy Dexter Jorgensen about her book, From Fame to Farm. Why would anyone choose to leave a successful career in the city to commit to a life of poverty in the Maine woods? This is the story of how one woman did just that. Janet Dexter sketched celebrities for the New York Times and other newspapers in New York and Boston in the 1920s and 30s. Her drawings appeared with critiques and reviews of plays, operas, and concerts. She was educated, well-traveled. How, then, did she come to marry Cola Storer, a backwoods widower with 15 children, and spend her life on his farm with no electricity or modern plumbing? That's the story we're going to tell today. So, Andy Dexter Jorgensen, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Fascinating story. We'll get into that. But you have a fascinating story. So I was like, I've got a couple of paragraphs here at the end of the book here. maybe we'll get a book on your life, autobiography of some kind. So just briefly here, and then we'll get into your aunt. So grew up near Boston, and you spent summers in Weld, Maine.
Yes, from the time I was a baby, yes.
Yeah, that's where your aunt went to and
lived her life. That's correct.
When did she end up going, in her 30s, 40s?
Well, she left the city in 1937, mm-hmm. but she had been going there for many, many years, also as a child.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of a family tradition.
It's a family tradition as well. That's correct, yes. And we had other family members who lived there year-long.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So back to you. Andrew Dexter Jorgensen, you love to paint. You have a Bachelor of Arts degree from Smith College.
That's correct.
So again, paralleling your aunt Drew.
This is absolutely right, but I didn't know it at the time.
Right. Oh, you didn't know at the time. Okay, yeah. So your aunt was just your nice aunt that you would visit.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you taught briefly, and then you married a Norwegian man.
I did. We met on a blind date, and I had been to Norway for a summer, staying with a family, and so we became friends, and then we decided to marry.
Oh, yeah. And then made your life in Norway.
We did. We did. Our oldest daughter was 6 weeks old when we moved to Oslo.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you lived in Oslo?
We lived in Oslo, but my husband changed jobs a couple of times, and housing is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And since housing was connected with the first job, we had to find another place to live.
Yeah.
We lived out in the country for about 5 years, and that was an interesting little episode because just 40 miles away, the dialect was totally different.
Really?
Yes. And so I had a bit of a challenge trying first to learn Norwegian and then trying to understand the dialect.
You had to learn it twice, essentially. Yeah,
in a sense.
I was just going to ask you, you didn't know Norwegian when you met your husband?
I knew a few words, but I did not know the language. No.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-mm. So you had to learn.
Yes, I did. And his family did not speak any English.
Yeah.
So that was good motivation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, imagine. Yeah. And then at a certain point, you go to Switzerland.
Yes, we had lived in Norway for about 14 years, but my husband was an adventurer. He wanted to try something new and got an opportunity to take a new job in Switzerland, in Geneva.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you taught at the International School of Geneva. You taught art.
Yes. I wasn't able to get any job until I had a work permit. And for a wife who's married to somebody who gets a has his own work permit, it usually takes 5 years.
Ah.
And so I volunteered, but then I started working after 5 years.
Yeah. So were you speaking English there? Did you have to learn German or what?
Geneva is French-speaking.
French-speaking, okay.
And so we spoke, at the school, they spoke both English and French. And for me, I had studied French, but I didn't know it terribly well. Mm-hmm. But my children had to learn both languages at the same time.
Uh-huh. So they would speak Norwegian and French, also English because of you, or what did they?
At home, when we lived in Norway, since I was trying to learn Norwegian, we spoke Norwegian at home.
Oh, okay.
And so I wasn't very good at teaching them English, but that changed when we moved to Geneva. So suddenly we had three languages in play.
Ah, and then at a certain point, your kids all end up in the U.S.
They do. They all decided to attend college in the United States. And after they'd finished that, they decided, I think maybe we'll stay here.
Huh.
And so that's when my husband and I decided that we would move. And he wanted to have warmth after having lived in Switzerland, Norway. And we moved to Florida. And so we stayed there for a good while.
Yeah. So I imagine it was warm. What? Tell me a little bit more about life in Florida.
Yeah. We moved to a place, to Delray Beach, which is not far from West Palm Beach on the north and Boca Raton on the south, on the Atlantic coast. And I had gotten a job teaching art at a local high school there. And we found a condominium almost right on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite time of day was the early morning when I was walked the beach as the sun was rising. And then I was ready for teaching day.
Yeah, yeah. At a certain point, you moved to Logan.
Well, my husband passed away in an airplane crash. And then I was hit by a hurricane. And then I was hit by another hurricane. And then the sheriff woke me at 3 in the morning. You've got to evacuate. There's a fire right across the street. We don't know if we can prevent it from coming across the street. That's when my daughter Nina said, "Mom, don't you see you're not supposed to stay there?" So when I was able to clean up the house and so forth, I sold well and moved to Logan because she was living here.
Yeah, all right, yeah. Well, quite the adventures, yeah. I think we probably do need a book on your life, but that'll be coming next after this. So just one more thing from your bio. You say you're international. Family includes dear children, their spouses, 7 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren. That includes American, Norwegian, Peruvian, and Iranian.
That's correct.
So by marriage?
By marriage, yes. That's right.
Yeah.
And now I have a grandson who's also married a Norwegian. And so I have 2 new great-grandchildren who are Norwegian-American.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, let's talk about your aunt. So this is Janet Dexter. I guess first, before we pick up her childhood, et cetera, give me a sense of sort of the life she would have had in New York and Boston, drawing these celebrity portraits.
Mm-hmm. You know, she grew up outside of Boston and had access to a good education. She was musical as well as artistic. And so she was able to go to the Art Students League in New York City. Mm. Now, that's a school that was one of the rare exceptions, I believe, that accepted both men and women. And so she was able to work with instructors who were experts in their field. And so she learned how to draw the human body, and she focused on faces and did a beautiful job. She'd always loved drawing and had written stories and so forth, but in New York, she really, really focused on portraits.
And she would, and in fact, you have reproductions of her portraits in the back of the book.
That's right. I've included 96 of them. I was trying to reach even 100, but it was difficult to find them that I could photograph well.
So I've just written down some of those 96.
Yes.
So Ethel Barrymore, Faye Bainter, Rudolph Valentino, Eugene O'Neill, Greta Garbo, Douglas Fairbanks, Helen Hayes, Edward G. Robinson, Will Rogers, Rudy Valley, Yehudi Menuhin, Marian Anderson, Ethel Merman, Kirsten Flagstad. So these would have been the prominent people of the time.
Yes, they really were.
Yeah. Would she have been known? Do you think, or certainly her portraits were known?
Her portraits were known. Well, how well she was known, I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly her name became known through anyone reading the newspapers and checking out these portraits. They were usually in conjunction with critiques or maybe talking about upcoming attractions.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Kind of stylized, but faithful. To the, you know, you do
yes.
recognize the people if you view these
yes.
portraits.
Yes. Particularly at the outset in the 1920s, middle of the 20s, her drawings were quite detailed. And in time, she was using different materials, I think, and they became a little bit more simplified. But you could always tell who it was.
Yeah. She would have known some of these people.
She would.
Yeah.
And she became very good friends with Ethel Barrymore's brother, Lionel. And Lionel even later on drove all the way up to the cabin in Maine. And there's some interesting stories about that little visit. But he had a very fancy roadster, and it was his pride and joy. Can I tell a little bit about that story?
Yes, definitely.
So he and Janet were speaking together in the parlor, and Janet's husband, whose name was Cola, was just sitting, laid back, smoking his pipe and listening on. And he looked out the window and looked back and looked out again. And then he said, "Hey, Lionel." And, "Yes, what is it, Cola?" "You got insurance on that car?" "Well, of course I do, because it's my pride and joy, yes." "Well," said Cola, "it's a good thing, because the cows out there chew on the convertible top."
Wonderful. Friends with Lionel, to the point where he came to visit her, I guess. Up in Maine. If you don't know who Lionel Barrymore is, you do know him as the villain in It's a Wonderful Life, right? That's at least one of his many, many, many roles.
Right. They had another brother. There were three of them, and I don't know if they lost both parents, but at least their mother, and had to work at an early age. And they worked on stage and other ways to earn some money.
Yeah. John Barrymore, they were all in a lot of movies, for example. So tell me a bit more about Janet's family. One thing that stood out to me is Janet's father apparently suffered from mental illness.
He did. This became evident after he had taken a trip, they say around the world. How extensive that was, I'm not sure. But his uncle was a collector of antiques, and he invited my grandfather to go with him. And this was a very exciting time for him. But when he came back, he discovered that his three brothers, with whom he had been working in a company called the Dexter Paint Company, they had evidently sold him out. And he suddenly had no work and was wondering how he was going to maintain his family. And I think that this was the beginning of obvious letdown. Maybe it had been evident to his brothers. I do not know. There's so much we don't know. He was sent to McLean Hospital, which is outside of Boston. It's four people who are mentally ill. And then he was institutionalized for over 12 years. And it saddens me greatly because of what I hear about the conditions in many of these institutions. And I wish I had known him, because he also was a very sensitive man. And I just know of one little poem he had written to my dad when Dad was young. So it's a loss, and I'm sure that my grandmother hated having to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. The family would do summers in Weld.
That's correct.
Just like your family did later.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me about, first of all, where is Weld located for us?
Weld is about 100 miles northwest of Portland, Maine. It's in the central part of the state, but west. And so I would say that it's basically in the foothills of the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. It's not very far from the state border.
Yeah. Small place today, it would have been small then, I think.
It is. It doesn't have a great deal of opportunity to grow, because people love it so much, they don't want to sell. That's one thing. There are camps or cabins. You know, in Maine, a cabin is called a camp. Mm-hmm. And they're all around the lake. And so my family is fortunate enough to have a camp there. But there are clusters of homes in the center of town, but the town has Yeah, it had a gas station, and now it's almost defunct. And it's got a little variety store for absolute necessities and a post office.
Mm.
And a library.
And a library. That's
yes.
Wonderful. How many people? What's population?
Oh, I would say probably about 300, 400.
Yeah.
For the winter population.
And then it would expand in the summer.
Then expands.
Yeah.
There is a boys' camp at the end of the lake, mm-hmm. and many of the boys who go to that camp end up coming to Weld in summers for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Sometimes these places have tensions between locals and summer residents. Any of that?
My experience is that we didn't get to know the locals. There was a kind of a silent wall. But I did have some family who lived there year-round, but I didn't get to know them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back to tell much more about Janet Dexter, who is our guest, Andy Dexter Jorgensen's aunt. And Andy Dexter Jorgensen has written a book about her aunt, Extraordinary Life. She drew portraits of famous people. In the 20s and 30s, at a certain point, she decided, I'm going to leave this life. And understandable, you want a simpler life. But then she decides to marry a widower with 15 kids and live a life with no indoor plumbing and just a kind of a strenuous life on the farm. And so Andy Dexter Jorgensen is trying to figure that out in the book and gives that story for us. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Why would anyone choose to leave a successful career in the city to commit to a life of poverty in the Maine woods? Well, that's the story essentially we're telling today. Andy Dexter Jorgensen has written a book about her aunt. The book is called From Fame to Farm. You can find that on Amazon, I think, right?
Yes.
So her aunt, Janet Dexter, had a successful career in New York and Boston, drawing portraits of celebrities, and those would be included with critiques and reviews of plays, operas, and concerts. That was in the 1920s and 30s. At a certain point, she left all that, moved to Maine, and married a backwoods widower with 15 children. We'll get into talking about that as that life as we go along. I was interested Chapter 4, The Dreamer, you say that Janet herself wrote a story in 1908, which she would have been pretty young then, and which presaged her what her life would be.
She had an intuition, I assume, but she wrote this story. She was about 13 years old, and she loved Weld. And I can picture her coming home from Weld and being very forlorn, and then writing this story about a young girl who also goes to a place that she calls Weldfield, and loves it, but then it becomes a romance where I can go into the details of the story, but anyway, I'm amazed that she was able to write this well at this young age and have a perception of the wealthy man from England who comes and tries to take away another family's well-being, and so the young man in the story is a member of the family who gets destroyed, and so they elope, they go to Weldfield, they have a child, and eventually it all turns out well with the family. I find it fascinating that at this point in time, she even has her father getting very upset with the young girl for not agreeing. Oh, I hadn't mentioned that she was supposed to marry this wealthy man who turned out to be the culprit in the unfortunate happenings of the young man. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Now, later in her life, Janet does get married, I think against the wishes of her family.
She does indeed. She does indeed. Oh, my goodness. This starts with her getting acquainted with an older man who is, they call him the woodsman at a summer camp. My dad, who was then a very young child, had gotten pneumonia. And so the parents felt that if their children went off to this summer camp, that it would be a healing process for my dad. But in the process, Janet is working together with these boys, her brothers and some others, and this woodsman. And the woodsman teaches them how to use a hatchet and even a pistol and how to make a cabin. Well, her brother, her older brother, teases her. Oh, that old woodsman has an eye on you. Well, she's 19, 20 years old, and he's 36. But he asks if he can meet her in New York City. And this then develops into a romance, and she agrees to marry him. But she knows her parents will be very upset because he has leanings, like many artists at the time, felt that communism was a very interesting concept. They're taking care of the poor, at least theoretically. And so he spoke with Janet a lot about this, and she always had leanings toward sympathy for poor people or people less privileged. So they marry, but of course her parents are livid, and they annul the marriage. I've tried to find documentation for this, and the family history people tell me if it's in Massachusetts, you will not find documentation at that time. This was in 1915. And so I just have to go by what the family says.
Mm-hmm. Let's use that as a segue to talk just briefly, at least, about how you tried to piece together Janet's life. So you knew her directly, but as a younger person, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So you would have talked to people who knew her. What else did you do to piece together her life?
I talked with relatives and got little tidbits here and there. There is this historical society in Weld is very active, and that is mainly thanks to one man, Sean Manier. And so I said, Sean, I would like to have a good talk with you. And he told me many of the anecdotes. And I hope that they're all true. I think he tends to exaggerate just a little bit. But he was a fun person to get information from. And then I had to do quite a bit of research to find these newspaper. Well, the clippings I had, they were at the Historical Society, thanks to a niece of mine who was working there one summer. And she found four huge scrapbooks filled with these clippings of Janet's portraits. It was her own set of scrapbooks, and they were glued in, and my goodness, they're almost 100 years old, and so you can imagine the condition that they're in. But I was able to take photographs of as many as I could, so that was one portion of my research. But then, of course, I had to make sure that I had copyright permission. So anything that was less than 95 years old, I had to get permission to use. And so the Boston Herald, they were all less than 90 years old, but they were very courteous and helpful and said, you can use whatever you want. So that was extremely helpful. The New York Times, I mean, I could use it up to 1927 because that was the 95-year limit at the time, but they couldn't find these drawings. And so I could have guessed, well, maybe I can use them anyway if they can't find them. But I decided, no, I'm not going to go that way. So I'm missing a couple of years there. But for the most part, I've got a pretty good collection.
I want to have you read a poem of Dorothy Parker that you include in your introduction here.
Yes. This is a called The Picture Gallery by Dorothy Parker. My life is like a picture gallery, with narrow aisles wherein the spectators may walk. The pictures themselves are hung to the best advantage, so that the good ones draw immediate attention. Now and then, one is so cleverly hung that though it seems unobtrusive, it catches the most flattering light. Even the daubs are shown so skillfully that the shadows soften them into beauty. My life is like a picture gallery, with a few pictures turned directly to the wall. Discreetly to the wall, sorry.
So why did you want to include this?
A couple of reasons. The poem itself, I think, is indicative of Janet's life. There were many things which she kept hidden. Facts about her family life, the fact that she wanted to elope and hide from her family, the fact that she was marrying a man she knew they disapproved of. And there's so many things about her life that I was trying to search for answers for. Why in the world she would move and marry a man who had 15 children. That was a curiosity to me. And so that kept me busy. But also because Dorothy Parker was a part of something called the Algonquin Round Table. This was a group of people who met in New York City after World War II. And I give a little bit of information as to how that started, but it's newsmen and women who had been active in the war but decided that the socialization that they had during the war in France was something they wanted to continue. So when they came back to New York, they said, well, let's meet at the Algonquin Roundtable, the Algonquin Hotel, excuse me. And so they did, and they liked it that so much that it became a routine. And Dorothy Parker was instrumental in getting many of the people together.
So let's talk about the big move. This you know, fascinating part of Janet Dexter's life. She was at least associated with celebrities. She drew their portraits for several years. Would have known some of them, these celebrities. Mm-hmm. Late 30s is when she decides that I'm going to leave this life in New York and Boston. I'm going to go to this main town that I love so much.
That's right. It wasn't just leaving. It was the times. I've got to remember that in the late 30s, you are in the middle of a depression. And the cities, Boston, New York, were horrifying. She wrote of people jumping out of windows to get rid of, so they couldn't stand living. There were long lines for soup kitchens. It was filth everywhere. And she had decided that it's time. I am going to leave all of this. And what plan she had, besides being in Weld, I really don't know. But she left Boston, and so I open the book with her entering Weld to start a new adventure.
Yeah. So, you know, this could have gone a different way. She could have just lived in Weld and been an artist and mm-hmm. associated with other artists there and lived downtown, such as it is, I guess, in Weld. But she meets this fellow, Cola Storer. Do we know how they met?
We know in my mind how they met,
okay.
But I really don't know precisely. What I do know is that she was playing the piano with a little band that held dances every Saturday evening. And when she had a break, she would join in the dances. And in my mind now, I have him coming along in one of these long contra dances, and he was strong, and he just swept her right off her feet, and then she wanted to know, well, who is this? Turns out that she already had met some of his children who passed her house as they walked home, and it was a 5-mile walk home, and she became good friends with them.
Mm-hmm. There's one story you tell, a funny story. She'd bake some cookies for them. They used them not for eating.
This is true. She had found out, this was after she had met Cola and taken a liking to him, that she was going to make him some ginger cookies. He loved those ginger molasses cookies. And so she baked up some, and she asked the kids if they would take them with her with them and deliver them. Well, they got as I think they were able to take a bus as far as what we know as Robertson Cemetery, which was still over a mile away. But they had to pass a brook. And being children, they decided, oh, well, let's skip some stones. And it was tough to find skipping stones. So then Joe gets this idea, well, why don't we use the cookies? Oh, let's try them. Well, of course, they don't skip in water terribly well, but this one looks as though it could fly. And, of course, he throws it, and it flies quite nicely. And then the others all try. And then along comes Janet, bicycling. And they're embarrassed, and they don't know quite what to do. So they stuff them back into their lunchboxes. But she has seen some of these flying missiles and asks, well, hey, you look like you're having a good time. What's happening? And so they tell her, and Joe was sheepishly says, well, we did use a few of your cookies. Oh, really? Do they fly well? And anyway, she joins in, and because she doesn't get angry, but just joins in, she makes good friends with that part of the family.
What would Janet have seen in Colastor, do you think? Why did she fall for him, do you think?
I think it was not only his physique, and I think that did have a good deal to do with it, but also he was a hard worker. And to think that he was trying to support this large family with subsistence farming, they managed to live, but you know, where are they going to get shoes for the kids? How will they have enough money to buy clothes? And so that was part of it. But I think maybe one of the main characteristics of Cola was his sense of humor. He and she could have wonderful laughs together.
So they do marry. This is, 1940?
1940.
And he's not just a groom, he's got 15 kids.
Right. Now, the story goes, and I think this is correct, that they marry. They have to go to Farmington, the next town, about 20 miles away. And, they go. He proposes, they get married right away, and she goes and lives right in the farm right away. And I'm sure some of the kids were wondering, what is she doing here? They knew her as a visitor, and some of them knew her as a friend, but to live with us, is she going to be an additional mouth to feed, or is she going to help us? What's going to happen?
Well, let's take a break, and we'll use that as a teaser for the life on the farm.
All right.
We'll talk about that. We're talking with Logan resident Andy Dexter Jorgensen. She has a new book out called From Fame to Farm. She's tracing the life of her aunt, Janet Dexter, who left a life of drawing celebrity portraits in New York and Boston to live in this small town in Maine and marry a widower and raise his, not all 15 kids, a couple of them
only
were
12.
Married, right? Only 12 is who she helped raise. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're telling a fascinating story of Janet Dexter. She had a career in New York and Boston in the 1920s and 30s, drawing portraits of celebrities. These appeared with critiques and reviews of plays, operas, and concerts in the major newspapers. She was educated, well-traveled. So why then did she marry Colastor, this backwoods widower with 15 children, spend the rest of her life on his farm with no electricity or modern plumbing up in Maine? So that's the mystery that her niece, Andy Dexter Jorgensen, is trying to write about in her new book, From Fame to Farm. You can find this on Amazon. So Andy Dexter Jorgensen, tell me a little bit about life on this farm. She was helping to raise 12 kids. This was no indoor plumbing. This was subsistence farming. Tell me a bit about this.
This is true. The only water that was the only plumbing, if you want to call it that, was some kind of a pipe hitch up to the kitchen sink. And water directly from a stream nearby came through that pipe and into the sink. And there was no spigot. You could not turn it on or off. And so it was constantly running. There was a three-holer in the shed. And that was it as far as a toilet situation was concerned. There was no electricity. And so they used kerosene lamps. And for cooking, she had a monster of a wood stove. And so every morning that would have to be filled, first with tinder and so forth. All you Boy Scouts would know about that. And get it going until it was a really hot affair. And then she could start cooking. And one thing that really impressed me was finding out that during the summer, she'd get all the vegetables in, and she would process them. And my cousin Joe tells me that she would spend August afternoons, all day actually, preserving the vegetables to be used during the wintertime. And so it's old-time living. It's pioneer-type living.
Mm-hmm. You write that she got clothes and other things for the kids through Sears and Roebuck, the catalog.
Yes, she had a catalog. And I don't know if anybody else remembers the Sears and Roebuck catalogs, but that's where she found her clothes. She always had a very simple house dress on, at least in the summer when I saw her. And a picture that I have of the family before she was part of the family shows these children with no shoes and with kind of ragged clothes and not very happy expressions on their face. But when we visited years later, she had been able to provide sufficient clothing for them and I think made a happy family.
Yeah.
She was always singing and humming and enjoying where she was.
Now, she would have driven up to Maine in her Model A Ford.
That's right.
I don't know if they had that, around.
How long they had that, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I know that I think it was in about 42, they bought a Jeep. And one story I love about her trying to drive that Jeep, one time I don't know if she had to shift or something that she wasn't quite used to, and she panicked. So she just threw her hands up in the air. And what do I do now? Of course, meanwhile, the Jeep goes down the slope. And luckily, it doesn't hit any rocks, but it settles in a pasture. And the kids, there were a bunch of kids in the Jeep. They go off and find some blackberries and so forth. And she comes down. And anyway, they were able to get on their way somehow. But I don't think that driving was her favorite, at least not driving the Jeep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Cola had a logging business in addition to his farm. Nothing he did really brought in huge amounts of money, but he had these various ways of trying to make a living.
Right. They had a 200-acre farm, and much of that land was forested. And the whole area around Weld in western Maine is forested. And so he was very capable in logging. And would cut down a tree. He'd figure out which ones would be the best and able to come down safely. There was one time that my aunt was with him, and of course this is in the wintertime. It's icy cold, and so he's just in the process of chopping this big tree down, and he says, "Oh my goodness. Watch out for the birds." And so she jumps. So she jumps into a snowdrift. And so when she comes out of the snowdrift, Cola looks at her and says, "What you doing down there?" and she, "Well, what were you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you know, the birds up there, that's what we call the upper branches. And if they fall on you, you're a goner. Hmm. So we have to yell. This is a name for the bird. Of course, I forget it right now. But anyway, they had a good laugh over that one. Luckily, she did not get hurt.
So Cola dies in 1979, Janet in 1980.
That's correct.
During my lifetime. So, you know, to me, somewhat recent, although it's 40-plus years ago. We just have a few minutes left here. I want to have you maybe revisit this kind of a central question. Why did Janet leave her life in Boston and make this change? I'm sure you've thought a lot about this.
I have. I really think that she had an innate need to be of service. And she felt that she disliked the inequality of consequences for a person's abilities. And so I think it was natural for her to go back to Weld, and perhaps natural for her to accept the responsibility that it was going to take care of all of these children. When she had first come to Weld and bought her little house there, she was helping with philanthropic things because of the Depression. And so her heart was in that, you know, going in that direction anyway. And besides, there must have been a great attraction for Cola, but I think as well this desire to serve.
Mm-hmm. So what do you take away from this, all of this work to try to get to know your aunt better? Of course, you knew her, at least, you know.
Well, I knew her as a child.
You knew her as a child. She seemed happy to you, right?
Yes. Whenever we went over to the farm, she would greet us with open arms and, "Hello, hello, hello. So nice to see you." And then she would tell us, "We have a new kitten." And she mentioned one time, "We just had a kitten that was born in the piano, so I've called him Debussy the Pussy." And she was just a happy gal. And I have one step cousin left, and he says that she was always humming. And I don't think a depressed person would go around humming all the time.
Mm-hmm.
She always was cheerful, patient, and kind.
Yeah. Well, the book is out and available now on Amazon. It's called From Fame to Farm. We've had with us the author, Andy Dexter Jorgensen. So this must have been a labor of love. Now that the book's out there, what do you think?
Well, I'm pleased that I can share this story. I considered having, you know, just keeping it within the family, but I thought that her story exemplifies something that I feel as well, that is too much inequality for the amount of work we put into something. One person puts a great deal amount into logging and another into business, and one succeeds financially and the other does not. And I would like to see a little bit more equalization.
Hmm. Well, we'll leave it there. We've been talking with Andy Dexter Jorgensen. Again, the book is From Fame to Farm. That's out and available on Amazon now. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.